And welcome back to Coast, Stone Circles and Structures. They're all over the planet. In a moment, Graham Phillips joins us. His latest work is called Wisdom Keepers of Stonehenge. That'll give you an idea of what we're talking about next on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Our special guest tonight, Graham Phillips, has been described as a historical detective, a modern-day adventurer, real-life Indiana Jones. He's been one of Britain's best-selling nonfiction authors for more than 20 years. In 1981, after working as a radio journalist and broadcaster for the BBC and editing a very popular monthly magazine, he turned his talents to investigating unsolved historical mysteries. And he has written at least 13-plus books in print now around the world and have been published in 10 different languages. Some of them include Atlantis and the Ten Plagues of Egypt, The Lost Tomb of King Arthur, and his latest here, Wisdom Keepers of Stonehenge. Graham, welcome. You were on our show almost 3 years ago with my colleague Dave Schrader. Welcome back.
Well, thank you very much for having me on, George.
How are things in the United Kingdom these days?
Well, we've got this Brexit nonsense that's just about tied up everything, but it is sunny and warm,
well, that's
which is unusual
good.
For here.
That's good. And a great job on Wisdom Keepers of Stonehenge. I want to talk with you about a lot of your works, but let's get into this. Exactly, geographically, kind of paint us the picture of Stonehenge for a lot of people who haven't been there. Where is it, and what's it look like?
Okay, Stonehenge is in central southern England. It lies on an area called Salisbury Plain, a fairly desolate area, if you like, very few houses around that area. It's a ring of stones about 15 feet high, some weighing 20 or so tons, joined together by a series of other stones placed along the top of them, which are called lintel stones, to form a series of arches running in a ring, which is around about 100 feet in diameter, with other stones placed in positions inside the main stone circle. And it's probably Britain's most popular tourist destination outside London.
Yeah, I would agree with that. Now, if you're standing there, as an individual standing there by the stones looking up, how big are they?
Well, I'm 6'2", and they're about, the tallest ones are about three times taller than I am.
Wow. Now, are they dug down underground as well, or do they just rest on the surface of the planet here?
No, if they'd just rested on the surface, they'd have fallen over years ago.
Okay.
They go down about one-third as far as they stand above the ground in order to keep there. And basically any stone that I'll be talking about, and whatever I say its height is, you can add another third to what's below the ground.
That's amazing. How do you think they moved them, and where did the stones come from?
Well, Stonehenge itself was built in a number of phases. It began around about 5,000 years ago. And the stones to build it wasn't the more complicated structure we know today, but a more simple arrangement of 6-foot standing stones in a ring. And there were between 50 and 60 of those. They no longer stand in that position, but archaeologists have worked out where they were based on newfangled scientific techniques called ground-sensing radar, which basically tells you where there was a pit dug in the past and then filled in again. But parts of these stones still remain within the pits that have broken off, and later they were moved inside the inner circle of Stonehenge. They were brought all the way from South Wales, about 150 miles to the west of where Stonehenge is. They know this because it's the only place in the country where the stone was quarried. It's called Bluestone. They've actually found the very quarries where it was made, and archaeologists now realize that it originally formed a circle built perhaps about 3,100 BC, in South Wales, in this mountainous area. And then when the people from that area decided to migrate to the more to the area where you could grow crops better in central southern England, they decided to move the stone circle with them.
Huh.
And they did that on barges around the sea and up along rivers until they got close to Stonehenge. And from then, they rolled them across the countryside by having about two or three people haul them along on rollers.
And Graham, let me ask you this from the outset. Do you think they had any extraterrestrial help at all?
Well, some people believe that getting the stones to stick on top of the other ones to form these arches would have required some kind of telekinesis or ancient form of technology. But all I can say is this. There is nothing being found by archaeologists in and around Stonehenge or any other stone circle that suggests that this was made by anything other than prehistoric instruments, prehistoric tools, which makes it even more astonishing, to be quite honest.
Absolutely. I mean, it looks kind of crude. I mean, it's not as sharply cut like the stones are for the Giza pyramids, but it's still a monumental effort.
Well, by the time the Giza pyramids were being built, they had bronze tools. In other words, they had metal tools by that point.
So these are older.
Stonehenge is older. It's in the period known as the Paleolithic, which means New Stone Age. The Neolithic, which means New Stone Age.
What would that be years-wise?
5,000 years ago.
5,000.
The Pyramids of Great of Egypt were built 4,500 years ago. And the Bronze Age didn't come to Britain until long after Egypt, until about 1200 BC, which is just over 3,000 years ago. So they were using, and we know this because of those being found, the remains of their tools scattered around areas like Stonehenge, animal antlers for picks. They were using the shoulder blades of animals like oxen for shovels.
Jeez.
And they were using flint or stone axes. And with those, they hacked the stone from the bedrock and shaped it and moved it to where it is. And ever likely that it's not as perfect as the stones of Egypt, but incredible that they managed to do it at all.
Exactly. And in terms of how many people were working on this, are there any estimates?
Yes, there are. The main part of Stonehenge we now know, which is the really difficult bit, was made from more locally quarried stones called sarsen stones. They were quarried about 20 miles away. That Stonehenge we know today was built around 2600 BC, just before the Great Pyramids. And it is estimated that the entire population of central southern England at the time was around about 30,000 to 50,000 people, very few. And it would have taken at least half of this amount, working pretty much full time in one capacity or another, for years on end to have built this thing. So whatever purpose it served, it seems to have been essential to the prehistoric people of Britain.
Now, you just brought up something fascinating. Whatever purpose it was for, do we really know why they built it the way they did and the way they shaped it in the circle formation?
Well, the thing is about Stonehenge, what you must realize, is although it's the most famous stone circle in Britain, it's far from the only one. There are estimated to have been over 5,000 of them throughout the country.
Wow. Like Stonehenge?
Not exactly like Stonehenge. There's over 1,000 of them still survive in various states of preservation. Many of them are quite small. Stonehenge is the only one with the arches across the top. But other circles of standing stones have survived throughout the country. Some of them very, very much bigger than Stonehenge. About 20 miles north of Stonehenge, there's a massive stone circle called Avebury, made up of 100 massive stones weighing up to 50 tons. And when I said that Stonehenge, as we now know it, is about 100 feet in diameter, Avebury is about 1,000 feet in diameter. I mean, it's huge. Now, as you mentioned then, these stats to have been made for some very practical purpose rather than simply religious, because Britain was subject to periodic migrations of people from continental Europe, and they all had different types of religions, yet they all joined in, from the archaeological evidence, they all joined in with the building of these stone circles. So these people had different religions, different customs. So for them all to be working on them suggests that whatever purpose Stonehenge and other stone circles served must have been some practical rather than religious function.
Yeah, you might be right about that, too. It's, and now, we call energy lines on this planet, as you know, Graham, ley lines. Are these structures built on these ley lines? And if so, how come?
Well, the ley line idea first started in the British Isles. Not only do we have all these stone circles all over the place, there are, if you go through the countryside and beside the road in hedgerows in the middle of fields and moorlands, you'll very often find single solitary monoliths, single standing stones, anything from 6 feet to 20 feet high, just stuck there in the ground. And it was worked out in, I think it was the 1920s, by a man called Alfred Watkins from Britain, that a lot of these stones tended to fall in straight lines across the countryside, linking stone circles together. His theory was that they were probably some sort of trackways or delineated trackways. But in the 1960s, another English guy, a man called John Michel, came up with the theory that they were possibly delineating lines of some kind of earth energy, channeling them towards stone circles so that they could allow some form of mystical energy to be at stone circles to help with all sorts of things, commune with the gods, to help with curing people, to whatever those energies were thought to be used for. And Alfred Watkins and John Michel referred to these lines as ley lines because of the prominence of which the word L-E-Y, ley, is found in the names of where these stone circles and standing stones are found. So archaeologists and historians will tell you there are no such things as lines of energy, but It is clear that for some reason the people of ancient Britain did align these standing stones in pretty much straight lines between certain stone circles, like Stonehenge at Avebury.
Do you think, Graham, that this might have been used as a sacrificial spot?
Well, it's a bit of a myth that it was used for sacrifices. There's a stone at Stonehenge in the middle of it called the Slaughter Stone because of the story that this is where sacrificial victims were slaughtered. It is has long been also referred to as the Altar Stone. We now know, archaeologists have now shown, that this stone was once an upright standing stone. In other words, in the middle of the stone circle, there was a single standing monolith that at some point over the centuries, because of erosion and weathering, had fallen over. So it was never meant as a slab for sacrifices to take place. And in all the other stone circles throughout the country, there have not been found slabs in the center that looked like they were where sacrifices would have taken place, nor has there been any evidence telltale signs of blood and decomposed animal matter in the soil in the center of the circles to suggest that these circles ever were used for sacrifices. When the Romans turned up 2,000 years ago, they basically wanted to give the Britons a lot of negative propaganda and started writing about how the people of Britain were savages and used to kill babies and all sorts of things. But there is no historical evidence for this at all.
That's amazing. Is it conceivable that this thing is some kind of astronomical clock?
Now, this is the theory that archaeologists are agreed upon. When viewed from the center of stone circles, such as Stonehenge, there are prominent stones placed in positions to start with where the sun rises or sets on important days of the year, such as the midwinter or midwinter solstices. At Stonehenge, for example, just a few days ago, thousands of people gathered at Stonehenge to watch the midsummer sunrise over a stone outside the main circle called the Heel Stone, and it rises right above it on Midsummer's Day. But it's not just the sun that these stone circles have stones aligned to. It's the various positions of the moon and the rising and setting of certain very bright stars at particular times of the year. And the general theory is that this was a giant astronomical calculator a kind of big clock, if you like, a one-year-long clock to tell the people exactly the time of the day or the night that they wear in the year to help with the growing, harvesting, reaping of crops. But the thing is, and this is my theory, okay, I agree with that, but you could do that without the need for these impressive stone circles.
Exactly, and all that work that went with it. You wouldn't need to do that.
Yeah, so the only reason to build something that's that precise is if you wanted to calculate some very specifically exact timings indeed. So that's what I decided to try and investigate, what Stonehenge was built for, why it was needed to be so accurate.
Interesting. Where do people get your book, Wisdom Keepers of Stonehenge?
They get it from, well, Amazon. It's available on Amazon. If anyone wants to know all about it, I've got a book. I've got a website, grahamphillips.net, and on the first page, you can click on an image of the book. It tells you all about it. There's some videos linked to YouTube, which I've made, that explains everything I've been talking about tonight in greater details. It's presumably available in, as they say, all good bookshops.
I'm sure it is. We're going to take calls with you next hour, Graham, about these subjects we're talking about. And after the break, let's talk a little bit about some of your other works, because they're all fascinating. What got you from being a radio journalist and broadcaster into studying some of these mysteries?
Well, the magazine that you mentioned that I edited was called Strange Phenomena.
Aha.
It was, as the title implies, investigating some of the world's mysteries. And I was fascinated by UFOs, ghosts, all that sort of thing. The only problem is that when you investigate these things, as I'm sure you're aware, you come up with very little solid evidence at the end of the day. You see enough to say, yeah, there is something weird going on out there, but you can't really ever get your hands on it and prove it. Whereas historical mysteries like, was there a Holy Grail? Was there an Ark of the Covenant? If so, what happened to it? You can actually get some solid answers. So I decided to investigate historical mysteries rather than paranormal ones, and hence started writing books.
Do you know our friend Lionel Fenthorpe at all? He lives out in your neck of the woods.
I'm afraid not. I tend to work alone most of the time.
Okay. He's out in Cardiff. Is that close by you?
Oh, no. Where I live is a place called Birmingham, which is smack bang in the center of England.
Uh-huh.
Cardiff is in South Wales, which is about, 130 miles from here.
All right.
But that doesn't sound big by American standards. But it
yeah, that's right around the block for us.
Yeah.
These architects of Stonehenge, how do you think they conceived it? What kind of a person or group got together to say, hey, let's do this. Let's get these huge stones and put them all around, and here's the way it's sketched out on some piece of papyrus or something. How do you think that was accomplished?
Well, the way it seems to have been done is that in the tombs of the people who seem to have been responsible for overseeing whatever happened at Stone Circle, so-called box tombs, which are often found near stone circles, archaeologists have found buried with the bodies pots containing substances that could only have been used for medicinal purposes.
Interesting.
Or analgesic properties.
Hold on for a second, Graham. We're at our break, but let's talk more about this when we come back, and then we'll also talk about some of your other works. Graham Phillips with us, his latest work, Wisdom Keepers of Stonehenge. We'll take calls with Graham next hour and you on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back. Graham Phillips with us, Wisdom Keepers of Stonehenge. Graham, we're talking about the architects of Stonehenge and how they planned something like this. I wonder, I mean, what went into it, do you think?
Well, what I was mentioning about the graves, the tombs of those who built them, that have been excavated by archaeologists, they found in there grave goods, including pottery. And inside these pots, scientific analysis has been able to work out that they contained curative extracts obtained from various plants. And, for example, you have something called the thorn apple. Now, the thorn apple doesn't grow in Britain anymore because the temperature is cooler now than it used to be. It's still found in California, better known as the Jimson weed. Now, the thorn apple, if you take an extract from it at a very certain time of the year, then it can, in the right doses, create a general anesthetic. You could put someone to sleep when performing, shall we say, painful operations like stitching wounds or even amputations. But it has to be extracted at a very specific time of the year. If not, you'll end up poisoning somebody and killing them. So this and a number of other extracts from different plants found in the tombs required very precise timing of the times of the year in order to extract these substances that were for curative purposes. Some of them needed to be obtained at a very specific time of night on particular nights of the year. For example, certain flowers give off chemicals to attract night pollinating insects, such as moths, only at a time when the moon is in a certain position, when the moths become active, and at a time when a very specific days of the year. Now, the only way that you could be able to do this is by having the kind of very accurate calendar, if you like, and timekeeping mechanism that something like Stonehenge and these other stone circles enabled you to do. And this is what I believe the stone circles are actually built for, in order to create pharmaceuticals. And what's absolutely fascinating is one of the substances that's been found at the tomb is acquired from mistletoe. Again, it can only be got at a very specific time of the year. And that very same substance is today used in chemotherapy for curing certain types of cancer. So it's even possible that the ancients 5,000 years ago had a cure for certain types of cancer that we're only rediscovering today.
That is true. It is remarkable. It truly is. And like you said, they're scattered all over the place.
Yeah, and the spread of stone circle building, at one time it was, I mean, stone circles are unique to the British Isles, Britain and Ireland. It was once thought, because there are stone monuments dating from the same period in places like France and northern continental Europe, that the civilization here came from there. But they built stone rows and single standing stones, but there are no stone circles like there are in Britain. But the latest scientific developments enabling stone circles to be dated, carbon dating, for example, of organic remains found beneath stones, have enabled some pretty accurate dating. And we now discover that the stone circle building tradition didn't start in the south of Britain, where you'd imagine if it had come from continental Europe, but in the far north off the coast of Scotland at a group of islands called the Orkney Isles. And on one of them, the oldest stone circle known to have been built, called the Stones of Stennes, still survives in part. Some of the stones still survive. And what's amazing is that within 100 years of that first stone circle being built, the tradition had spread throughout the British Isles until about 100 years later, the first of Stonehenge's stones were put into place in central southern England. So it spread very rapidly.
Graham, is Stonehenge guarded so nobody can deface it or anything like that?
It is today. When I went there years ago, you could just camp in the middle of it overnight, which I did. People would just turn up. But because people started hacking bits off to take home as souvenirs, it's now all fenced off. There's a wonderful visitor center there with reconstructions of what stone has served would have looked like originally. And there's also reconstructed villages there showing the kind of buildings that the people who built Stonehenge lived in, simple stone and mud huts, basically. And you are driven with a little coach from where the visitor centre is along a little road that takes you to Stonehenge a couple of miles away. And then you can walk around. You can get pretty close to it, but you can't get inside and actually touch the stones. But for those who really want to go and touch these ancient stones, and for somewhere built around about the same time as Stonehenge, where I mentioned before, the Avery Stone Circle, about 20 miles to the north of Stonehenge, is absolutely massive. It's so big it surrounds an entire village. And you can just walk around that. You can spend the night. You can camp there. I even had a friend once who's been on your show, I believe, Andrew Collins.
Oh, yeah, good person.
A number of books about the same sort of things as I do. He bought a cottage in the middle of the Stone Circle and lived there for a couple of years.
Wow.
So you can go to other stone circles like Avebury, visit them day or night and stay there, but not Stonehenge.
It is amazing that there's so many and so similar. It truly is remarkable. There's got to be a purpose. Could they be tied in together, all of them, almost like some kind of digital matrix?
Well, there is a theory. I'm not saying that I necessarily subscribe to this, but, I mean, I've figured out what could be a practical explanation to why these stone circles were built in order for them to cultivate these medicinal crops. But that would not explain why they had, some of them had to be so big. I mean, a lot of stone circles are relatively small, made up of, say, 20 stones, just about 4 or 5 feet high, in a circle maybe only 30 feet in diameter. And you could pretty much work out where the stars are and the moon is at the right time of the year in order to make the kind of calculations we're talking about. So why was Stonehenge so elaborate? It didn't need to be. Why is Avebury so big? It didn't need to be. These places obviously took on more than just a practical consideration for harvesting. And they probably acquired some kind of mystical status over the years, because those who knew how to use them, the priesthood, the shamans, whatever you want to call them, that were actually officiating at the stone circles, they would have had tremendous respect from people. They would have been considered almost magical and in tune with the gods. So they probably became the religious elite too. So the smaller stone circles, let us say, were like small parish churches, where something like Stonehenge and Avebury were like cathedrals, and they were built to impress. And Stonehenge, impressed by its ingenuity of hauling stones on top of the other, whereas the builders of Avebury decided to impress with sheer size. And some people believe and claim to have been cured of diseases and to have received, shall we say, spiritual enlightenment by going to certain still pretty intact stone circles. And it is thought that this might be due to the fact that the ley lines that are marked out by these single standing stones every so many miles in a straight line across the countryside are channeling in some kind of energy, in the same way, shall we say, as the acupuncture lines of the body are regarded in China. You put a needle in one place and you cure some other part of the body. And it has been suggested that these stones that are placed into the earth were like needles of stone. They form a kind of a geomantic, earth-centered acupuncture, if you like. So, I mean, I'm not saying that I necessarily believe that. I've just taken an overall view of stone circles, put all the information out there for people to make up their own ideas, then really focused on what archaeology has told us about the astonishing cures that these people had.
You wrote another book that came out earlier this year called The Green Stone. Tell us about that.
Ah.
Fascinating.
Well, the Green Stone, that's at the other end of my life. That was the first book I ever had published, back when I was investigating the paranormal, right back in 1979. When I was still a young man, that it's been republished this year.
Uh-huh.
Now, quite a long story, but to give you a brief outline, a legend survived that in the British Isles, there was a queen called Mary Queen of Scots,
right,
who lived in the 1500s. She was a queen of Scotland. She was deposed. She fled to Britain. She was a cousin of our queen, Queen Elizabeth I. And basically, eventually, Queen Elizabeth I had Mary Queen of Scots executed because she was a Catholic and Queen Elizabeth was Protestant. Now, it is said that she had a green stone set into a ring, Mary Queen of Scots, and this green stone was supposed to have divine power. It was supposed to be some sort of holy relic. Some legends said that this small green stone was the philosopher's stone of alchemy. It could turn base things into gold. Others said it was something called the Lapsit Exilis, which was a stone that had once apparently belonged to the Knights Templars, which could cure ills or grant eternal life. But this stone was, when Mary Queen of Scots was executed, the stone was hidden, and a series of clues were supposedly left in an old Elizabethan manor house called Harvington Hall in central England that, to lead to where this stone was hidden. Now, everybody thought that this was just a myth until in relatively recent years, the old Elizabethan house was renovated, and behind oak panelling, they discovered these strange pictures painted on the wall, known as the Nine Worthies, as they depicted nine heroic characters from history. And the central figure was a youthful King Arthur wielding Excalibur. And behind him is depicted a hill upon which his knights were gathered. This, we decided, was myself and Andrew Collins, who I mentioned before, and a few others, decided that this must have been the secret code, if you like, to reveal where this green stone was hidden. Cutting a long story short, King Arthur is the central figure. This hill with his knights on it behind him is there too, in the central part of the paintings. Nearby, just a few miles from Harvington Hall, is a place called Knight's Hill. And at the bottom of it, there is a bridge crossing a little stream feeding a lake called Arthur's Bridge. And because the actual pictures were called the Nine Worthies, we decided that the number nine was important. So we went to this area, found the bridge did date from the Elizabethan times. Arthur's Bridge below Knight's Hill. We, at the end of the day, we took nine stones down and nine stones across from the central part of the bridge and removed the stone, and behind it there was a short sword or dagger heavily encrusted with years of silt and sediment. When we had it cleaned up by a university, it was discovered that it basically, I could go on with this story forever, but right, it basically held the coat of arms of Mary Queen of Scots plus a clue to where the stone was hidden, which actually happened to be a few miles from there at a place called the Swan's Neck, which is a bend in a river, and a mound there, a few feet down inside. We dug down, and there was this brass casket that was dated
amazing
to the period in question, which contained the green stone.
Now, once you opened that up, though, weren't there some paranormal experiences, like dark figures that showed up and strange things like that?
Yeah, well, until then, it was all sort of scientific research, if you like, or historical research.
And then the paranormal world opened up, didn't it?
It did. We took the stone back to the headquarters of the magazine that we were running at the time, called Strange Phenomena. And almost at once, weird things started to happen. The lights would blow, and electrical appliances would suddenly short out. The whole place, every evening, would fill with this strange incense-smelling smoke. Boxes of magazines piled up there would, heavy boxes of magazines would like be shifted around of their own accord. People saw with their own eyes objects moving around. We even had the BBC television crew turn up and film this smoke appearing. No one could figure out where it came from. We had the electricity company come round to find out if there was faulty wiring. Nothing. So this stone, it seemed, did really seem to have some kind of supernatural power.
Wasn't there some kind of blue gelatinous stuff that came oozing out of the walls?
Yeah, it was. This was before the film, The Amityville Horror, came out of the book. In that, they've got all this gelatinous substances coming out the walls. Well, before that happened to them in Amityville, we had the same thing. One day we returned to the magazine headquarters to find there was like this as you say, blue gelatinous substance oozing from the walls in various parts of the building. We even called the police in because we thought there might have been a break-in and people had been throwing stuff around. And they analysed this stuff, and they had absolutely no idea what it was. And on my website, if you go onto grahamphillips.net and you click on the green stone picture cover of the book, and you'll see a description of it there, there are actually photographs and images from the newspapers recording it at the time, plus videos, some of them taken at the time, of the people that saw all this stuff being interviewed back in 1979.
That's amazing. All right, Graham, stay with us. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back. I want to talk a little bit about your work, The Lost Tomb of King Arthur, and we'll take phone calls about everything we've talked about tonight when we come back.